pleasure to be back at Olma again. I missed being here with all of you last month. And my brother and I had a wonderful road trip. I hope you guys have all been having a great summer as well. I don't know about you, but I'm loving the heat. Just loving it. Keep me away from that ice and snow. You know? Every winter, as I'm shoveling the ice or shoving the snow or chipping the ice, whatever you do with that stuff, I think to myself, what were my ancestors thinking when they moved here? And from time to time, I've actually asked people at work who've immigrated from other countries, especially in the wintertime, I'll say, so, like, why did you move here? And almost always their answer is one of two things. Either it's so much safer, or there's so much corruption where I come from. And that sets me back and makes me think about things a little more important than ice and snow. It makes me think about the country we live in, which for all of its shortcomings, and there are some massive ones, it's a pretty great place to live. I mean, we have freedom, we have health care, we have poutine and Nanaimo bars. What's not to love about Canada? You know me, I'm all about food. But what if that were to change? What if, in the snap of the fingers, all of that were to be taken away? It could happen. Look how close Europe came to experiencing that under Hitler. What if our freedoms were taken away? What if we weren't as free to worship God as we are? What if we became persecuted? Because don't forget, we have brethren this very day who live in fear of their lives, who have laid down their lives even while they live for the sake of the gospel. In fact, just within the past couple of months, a Facebook friend of mine who does mission work in Thailand posted this. Had six for our B&B study today, a Bible and a burger is what they call it. One won't let me take his picture, and another is in the process of changing his name because their Islamic families in their place of origin are offering money to have them killed since learning of their conversion to Christ. Pray for them. What if that was us? Would we still be as eager to assemble with each other as Christians? Would we still be as insistent on living for Christ as we do today, where it's so easy? Today we're going to be talking about Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. We're going to be looking in Daniel chapter 3 for most of our time. Although, to get to know the players in this particular play, we would need to go back to Daniel chapter 1, where we meet Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar is probably the most powerful person in the known world at that time, the king of Babylon. He has been conquering nation after nation, deporting the people that he's conquered to Babylon and repopulating their land. I don't know if he repopulated. That was Assyria. Anyway, he has been flexing his muscles. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who at the beginning were known by their birth names of Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, were three of those people, along with their friend Daniel, who were all deported from Judea to Babylon. Because Nebuchadnezzar brought Jews in, I think, three different installments. At the very beginning, he wanted the best of the best. He wanted people of nobility and or people who were young and good looking and or people who had administrative skills. That's the type of people he wanted. And he brought them to his kingdom, and he had them trained thoroughly in all matters pertaining to Babylon. And after about a year of such training, Daniel 1:17, as for these four youths, Hananiah, Mishael, Azariah, and Daniel, God gave them learning and skill in all literature and wisdom, and Daniel had understanding in all visions and dreams. At the end of the time, when the king had commanded that they should be brought in, the chief of the eunuchs brought them in before Nebuchadnezzar. Now listen to this. And the king spoke with them, and among all of them, none was found like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Therefore they stood before the king, and in every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king inquired of them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and enchanters that were in all his kingdom. Can you imagine that? Because God gave them their abilities, Nebuchadnezzar, when he tested them, these guys not only passed the test, they blew it out of the water, as they say. They really aced the test, and Nebuchadnezzar was impressed. Okay, now that we've met the players in Daniel 1, let's turn to the story in Daniel chapter 3. In the first 7 verses of Daniel 3, we see that Nebuchadnezzar builds an image. Well, that doesn't necessarily sound that impressive until you find out that the image is as tall as a 9-story building. That's impressive. It's 9 feet wide. That's pretty good. And it's solid gold. Wow. Okay, that takes impressive to a whole new level. Here's a guy who says, I'm going to make a god, and it's going to be massive, and everybody has to worship it, you know? My first thought when I read this was pride. This is just pride gone out of control. And when I mentioned to Ashley, she said, well, think about it. She said, you know, he's got all these diverse people from all different races and cultures and religions, and he has to try to make them into one cohesive people. What better way to do it than to try to unite their religions? Okay, hadn't thought of that, but I think she's got a point. But for whatever reason, whether for pride or for unifying religion, obviously from where we sit, we know that this was really a bad thing to do. Right? Because if it was out of pride, it was the wrong motives, and if it was for religion, it was the wrong god. You don't make your own. But Nebuchadnezzar could hardly be expected to know about the one true God, not having been introduced to him, shall we say. Once Nebuchadnezzar has created this image, he summons, not invites, summons all officials in his kingdom. The Bible specifies these in great detail, the satraps, the prefects, the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the justices, the magistrates, and all the officials. We get the impression he wants everybody to come to its dedication. And he announces to them, when you hear the music, specifically, it's again specifies in great detail the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music. Doesn't that sound delightful? Fall down and worship the image. Or, it's your choice, either worship the image or be thrown into a burning fiery furnace. So, they do this, except Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego don't do this. I'm sure Daniel didn't either, but for whatever reason, this story specifies these three guys. And in Daniel 3:8, we read that Chaldeans brought charges against the Jews. Therefore, at that time, certain Chaldeans came forward and maliciously accused the Jews. Now, the Chaldeans were part of the same people group, the same nation as Nebuchadnezzar. So although you've got the Jews and all these other people coming into Babylon from everywhere, these are Nebuchadnezzar's peeps. Okay, so they come to Nebuchadnezzar, and it says they maliciously accuse the Jews. Interestingly, the literal original language in this place says, ate the pieces of the Jews. So, you know, you get the picture here. We're going to have these guys for lunch. And it says that they brought these accusations against the Jews, not against Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. It wasn't enough to just single them out. They were accusing all the Jews. Verse 12, there are certain Jews whom you have appointed over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, pay no attention to you. They do not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up. So we see that eventually they do get around to specifying these three guys in particular, but they start out just accusing the Jews. And in verse 13, we read, Nebuchadnezzar, in furious rage, commanded that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego be brought. Have you ever seen somebody in a position of power, maybe your boss, go from wonderful to warpath in 60 seconds? Nebuchadnezzar was delighted with these three in chapter 1. He had tested them. He thought they were wonderful. He promoted them to positions of power. But boy, let them defy any command of his, even just bow down and worship my image. And all of a sudden, the guy snaps. In verse 14, he says, is it true? So at least Nebuchadnezzar gave them the benefit of the doubt. And before they had a chance to answer, he goes on, now, if you're ready, we'll go through this exercise again and fall down and worship, okay? But if you don't, you shall be immediately cast into a burning fiery furnace. And who is the God who will deliver you out of my hands? One of the enemy's best tactics is intimidation. The best defense is a good offense, and they can be mighty offensive. Let's take a look at some attempts at intimidation in the New Testament. I think this is important to spend a little bit of time looking at, because this is still today one of the enemy's best tactics, intimidation. They're trying to make us feel embarrassed, humiliated, whatever. The first two that we'll look at both come from John chapter 7. The Pharisees and the chief priests sent officers out to pull Jesus in for questioning. And in John 7:45, the officers came to the chief priests and Pharisees and said to them, who said to them, why did you not bring him? The officers answered, no one ever spoke like this man. The Pharisees answered them, have you also been deceived? Have any of the authorities or the Pharisees believed in him? But this crowd that does not know the law is accursed. You know, just let's snap at these guys and make them feel really foolish for having been impressed by Jesus. One of the things that we sometimes see in intimidation, and we see it here, is choosing to ignore inconvenient facts. Have any of the authorities or the Pharisees believed in him? Well, in verse 50, Nicodemus, who is one of them, said to them, verse 51, does our law judge a man without first giving him a hearing and learning what he does? Nicodemus had huge respect for Jesus. He's the one who went to Jesus by night in John chapter 3. So the Pharisees replied to Nicodemus, are you from Galilee too? Search and see that no prophet arises from Galilee. Well, guess what? Isaiah 9:1, nevertheless, there will be no more gloom for those who were in distress. In the past, he humbled the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali, but in the future, he will honor Galilee of the nations by way of the sea beyond the Jordan. The people walking in darkness have seen a great light. On those living in the land of deep darkness, a light has dawned. So yes, Pharisees, in fact, it does say that a prophet will come out of Galilee. John chapter 9, two chapters later. This is the story about the healing of the man born blind. And time after time, after he's healed, the Pharisees keep coming to him, asking him questions, often the same ones, over and over and over. And finally, in John 9:32, the man born blind who had been healed says to the Pharisees, never since the world began has it ever been heard that anyone opened the eyes of a man born blind. If this man were from God, he could do nothing. How can you argue with that logic, right? They answered him, you were born in utter sin, and would you teach us? And they threw him out. Wow. Acts chapter 5. Peter and John have been charged with not preaching in the name of Jesus anymore. And they find them preaching in his name again. We charged you strictly not to teach in this name, yet here you have filled Jerusalem with your teaching, and you intend to bring this man's blood on us. Intimidation. The enemy tried it then. The enemy tries it now. It's important for us to be aware of these tactics so that they don't take us by surprise. If we're ready for it, we won't be inclined to back down and slink away, but we will be ready to stand up for what we believe in the same way that these three men did, at whatever cost. Our reading this morning shows the attempts at intimidation by the rulers of the world. And what's God's reaction when these rulers try to conspire and say, let's break their bonds and cast away their yokes from us? God laughs at them. How cute that they want to try to conspire against the God of the universe. But then, after God has a good laugh, he gets mad and reminds them who the king really is. Psalm 2, verse 6. As for me, I have set my king on Zion, my holy hill. I will tell of the decree. The Lord said to me, you are my son. Today I have begotten you. Then he reminds them of how one should respond to God. Now therefore, O kings, be wise. Be warned, O rulers of the earth. Serve the Lord with fear and rejoice with trembling. Kiss the Son, lest he be angry and you perish in the way, for his wrath is quickly kindled. Blessed are all those who take refuge in him. There's two choices that the would-be intimidators can have. They can keep trying to intimidate and incur God's wrath, or they can reach out in love to God and be accepted by him. So again, don't let them intimidate you. Let them laugh at your old-fashioned, antiquated values. That's what we'll be told that we have. Let them take whatever they want away from us, because they cannot take the only thing that is truly of value, your faith, amen, your salvation. They come from God, and nothing can ever take that away. Back to Nebuchadnezzar's question of intimidation. You shall be immediately cast into a burning fiery furnace, and who is the God who will deliver you out of my hands? Let's see the fourfold response of our three young men. The first thing they said to them, to him in chapter 3, verse 16, "We have no need to answer you in this matter." That's a pretty gutsy response to say to the most powerful king in the known world. "We answer to a higher power. We don't need to discuss this with you." But although we don't need to answer you, your question does have an answer. Who is the God who will deliver you out of my hands? In verse 17, they say, "Our God, whom we serve, is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace." Full stop. God is able. Okay. God created the universe. Do you think that a simple man-made fiery furnace is too much for him? "We don't need to answer you in this matter. We answer to a higher power. But God is able." Point number two. Point number three in the same verse, "And he will deliver us out of your hand, O king." They were convinced that God would deliver. Never doubt the willingness of God to rescue us, although recognize that that rescue might look different from what we envisioned. And even for these three, rescue ended up looking different from how they envisioned. That's supposition on my part, because it doesn't tell us how they envisioned the rescue to happen. But the true rescue that we have received from God came 2,000 years ago in the form of a cross. Anything further that God chooses to do for us, it's just God heaping on extra grace. But God has given us salvation, and that is enough. Amen. It says of Jesus in 1 Peter chapter 2, later on in the chapter that Ian was reading, "When they hurled their insults at Jesus, he did not retaliate. When he suffered, he made no threats. Instead, he entrusted himself to him who judges justly." Jesus knew what it was like to not have that God who was capable of delivering come through with that deliverance. But what that has done for us is amazing, because it says in Hebrews that Jesus encountered weakness when he lived on earth. And because of that, he is someone who can identify with how we feel. And the Hebrew writer says, "Therefore, let us approach the throne of grace with confidence, that we might receive mercy and grace to help us in our time of need." God doesn't always deliver in the way that we expect, but he has given us the deliverance that matters. Then Nebuchadnezzar was filled with fury, and I missed point number four. He will deliver us. Point number four, "But be it known to you, O king, that we will not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up." Even if God does not choose to deliver, as we believe he will, even if he doesn't, it doesn't change a thing. We still will not worship that image. Then, verse 19, Nebuchadnezzar was filled with fury, and the expression of his face was changed against Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. This is the second time in seven verses that we read this king, who originally thought so much of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, is furious. The Christian is told to be quick to listen, slow to speak, and slow to become angry. Obviously, Nebuchadnezzar was not a Christian. He had such extreme pride that it seems he snapped any time anyone disagreed with him. What about you? Do you have a short fuse? Do you have anger management issues? What are we saying when we snap anytime someone wrongs us? Who do we think we are? The king of the world? Are we so conceited that everyone must be on their best behavior around us and be oh so careful that they don't offend us? James 4:1, what causes fights and quarrels among you? Don't they come from your desires that battle within you? 1 Peter 5:5, all of you, clothe yourselves with humility toward one another, because God opposes the proud, but shows favor to the humble. Humble yourselves, therefore, under God's mighty hand, that he may lift you up in due time. Don't be a Nebuchadnezzar. Don't give in to rage anytime someone responds differently from how you expect. And if you should find yourself in this kind of rage, stop and ask yourself why you think you have the right to respond in that way. I mean, if it's against you, if it's, you know, there are other times when righteous indignation is called for. If you see someone hurting someone else, that's a different story. But we're talking about people offending us. Then Nebuchadnezzar was filled with fury, and the expression of his face was changed against Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Nebuchadnezzar takes some extreme measures in his extreme fury. Whether to make an example of these men or just to quench that fury, we're not told. But we do read that he ordered the furnace heated seven times more than it was usually heated. Like I said, extreme. And he ordered some of the mighty men of his army to bind Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and to cast them into the burning fiery furnace. Then these men were bound in their cloaks, their tunics, their hats, and their other garments, and they were thrown into the burning fiery furnace. Because the king's order was urgent and the furnace overheated, the flame of the fire killed those men who took up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. That's fury. The next picture is such an extremely beautiful picture of how God rescues. Not only did he punish those who threw Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego into the furnace, but he did not magically prevent the furnace door from opening. It did open, and they did fall in. Again, God's deliverance looks different sometimes from what we expect. But once in there, Nebuchadnezzar suddenly notices that the number of people in the furnace does not agree with the number of people thrown in. Furthermore, Nebuchadnezzar's take on the fourth one says, the appearance of the fourth is like a son of the gods. Further, he saw the men who had been bound walking about freely, along with the fourth one, in the midst of the fire, unhurt. Do you know what a helicopter parent is? A parent who is hovering over the child at all times, lest little Johnny perish the thought, scrape his knee? God is not a helicopter parent, swooping in to rescue at each challenge. How many opportunities for growth would be lost if he were? But God is always there to walk with us, to comfort us, to encourage us, to strengthen us. I wonder, in the midst of the furnace, if these three guys had the words of Isaiah 43:3 in their minds. When you walk through the fire, you will not be burned. The flames will not set you ablaze. The context of that passage is particularly comforting. The previous chapter, Isaiah 42, ends up reflecting on future punishment at that point, meaning the captivity in Babylon, that God's people would be encountering because of their sin. And right in the midst of this prophecy of future punishment come these beautiful words. Do not fear, for I have redeemed you. I have summoned you by name. You are mine. When you pass through the waters, I will be with you. When you pass through the rivers, they will not sweep over you. When you walk through the fire, you will not be burned. The flames will not set you ablaze. As the hymn writer has so beautifully reflected this verse, when through fiery trials thy pathway shall lie, my grace all-sufficient shall be thy supply. The flame shall not hurt thee. I only design thy dross to consume and thy gold to refine. God is always with us and will give us comfort and strength even in our deepest, darkest hours. Are you struggling right now with unspeakable challenges? Do you feel like God isn't responding to your pleas for help? Jesus is walking with you right now in the midst of your own fire. Know that he is. His heart is touched with my grief. He's not some distant God who wound up the planet and set it spinning and walked away. He is walking with you in the midst of your own fire. Because he himself suffered when he was tempted, he is able to help those who are being tempted. Hebrews 2:18. Well, Nebuchadnezzar summons Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego to come out of the furnace. Obviously, there really was fire in there because it consumed the guys who threw them in. And yet, no hair nor garment was singed, and there was no smell of fire on them. That smell of smoke can be pretty bad, right? If you've ever had a house fire, you know how hard it is to get that smell of smoke out. But none. So what's Nebuchadnezzar to do? He's got all these officials around still. Fortunately, he was smart enough to know when he was beaten. And he relented immediately to the point of a considerable reversal of his own law. Not a complete reversal, but almost. Now, instead of everyone having to worship Nebuchadnezzar's image, it was now forbidden to speak anything against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. They would be torn limb from limb and houses destroyed if they did. He still doesn't appear to have become a monotheistic God follower, but at least he had enough sense to recognize that there was, quote, no other God who is able to rescue in this way. Nebuchadnezzar's humbling would be complete in the next chapter. And at the end of the story, he promoted Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego within Babylon. So, whether we face mild intimidation in our present-day setting of freedom, or whether in future years we find ourselves in persecution and oppression, let us always remember that we answer to a higher power, that we should never doubt the abilities of our God. He is able to deliver. That we should never doubt the willingness of our God to rescue us, and yet put that in terms of the fact that the rescue that is really meaningful has already happened at the cross. And number four, may we always have the unconditional devotion exemplified by these three men, and modeled most perfectly by our Lord himself, that regardless of the deliverance that we envision God granting us, regardless of whether God chooses to heal or to save in a physical point of view, that we will not turn back from worshiping God. We are called to unconditional devotion to the God who has already done the rescuing, even in the face of adversity. Our closing hymn says, "Oh, for a faith that will not shrink, though pressed by every foe, that will not tremble on the brink of any earthly woe." And the last verse, "Lord, give us such a faith as this, and then whate'er may come, we'll taste even here the hallowed bliss of an eternal home." May that be our prayer as we sing this hymn and as we go throughout our lives, to have a faith that will not shrink, though pressed by every foe. Hymn number 540. Let's stand and sing.